Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Thank you for joining us tonight. I am one of your hosts, Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And it is July 3rd, which means tomorrow is the 4th of July here in the United States of America. So I think some people are already taking off and traveling for that, but we've got a very good show tonight. Let's see what other information I need to give out. We're starting part two of Hitler's Table Talk, which is starting in 1942, the 1st of January, a year that has a lot of action and a lot of change. And this first part, Ray, it's really full of a lot of well-known people, right?
Right.
That Hitler's talking about. Well, I think it's very interesting. And there's a lot of little bits and pieces about this, that, and the other thing. But some of it is a longer section about one particular subject. But there is a lot of variation.
Yes, very much.
So we'll go ahead and get started if you're ready.
Yeah, I'll just say one thing about, for those of you that might be following along in the book, our section tonight starts on page 163. And as far as the totality of the book, this is about 22 or 23% that we've already done. And so if you're following along in the book, we begin tonight on page 163.
And if you're not following in the book, then you know how far along we are in the book. So you're saying we're about 20% of the way through.
A little bit over 20%, Carolyn, because we're on 163 and it goes to 722. So that's between a fourth and a fifth finished.
Well, that's quite a chunk, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts to go fast. But I know this is a very exciting year. Some of it's good and some of it's not as good. So
right.
We'll have to just be prepared for it. So we've got this is a midday. You can go ahead and give that information.
Okay.
I won't take it away.
We'll start here with the 1st of January, 1942, midday. Special guests, Himmler, Reich Minister Dorfmüller, and Undersecretary of State Kleinmann.
Okay, and you know what? I didn't go to the, I'm going to do that right now while you're reading. I'm going to go to the timeline and
Okay. Check
along as we go along, because I forgot to do that.
It's quite brief anyway. The Führer speaking says, I'm in favor of great public works, building of tunnels, etc., being carried out for the duration of hostilities by prisoners of war. Any fool can be put in charge of them. It would be wasting German labor to impose such tasks on it. And that's a just very brief statement right there. To me, a lot is said right there. What he's revealing is there is an acute shortage of labor for all the things that need to be done, meaning, of course, that he needed the people in the concentration camps for labor. That's what they were for. They were not extermination.
Well, he's saying here... He's saying prisoners of war.
Yeah, POWs.
Yeah. That's not to say, I wouldn't call that the people in the concentration camps.
Well, some of those POWs
were in camps, but yeah. That, you know, it's just that people think about that differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just so happens that on January 1st, 1942, 26 Allied countries signed the declaration by United Nations during the Arcadia Conference. Well, you know, they were getting all these other people to sign on and working on the United Nations already.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
1st of January, 1942, evening, special guest Himmler. I never bother about the price of things except when we are concerned with purchasers of modest means. As for the rich, opportunities should be invented of making them spend their money. One day, the Gauleiter of Baden came to confide in me his fears concerning Baden-Baden, which he told me was losing its source of revenue. The Jews, who formerly had been the mainstay of its clientele, had been deserting the resort since 1933. There was no question of granting Baden-Baden a subsidy. The resort was viable on condition it was endowed with a casino. I didn't hesitate for a second, and I authorized gambling there.
Yeah, so that was a spa area, Baden, and also called Baden-Baden. There was a lot of hot water springs. So there was a lot of what you would call tourist establishments where people would come, and that was probably a big part of their income. And he didn't want that income to fall down. And so Hitler didn't show that he had any qualms about allowing them to have a casino.
Right.
Yep.
Okay, moving on to the night of the 1st and 2nd of January, 1942. Discussing a letter from Frau von Oeynhausen, this is in a shortened in here in the book, is CHR period SCHR, who's referring to Christian Schrader or who, examined the possibility of replacing religious instruction in schools by a course of general philosophy so that children should not lose the sense of respect in the presence of things that transcend our understanding. Someone proposed that this new type of instruction should not be described as philosophy. It would be more like an exegesis of National Socialism. The Führer gave his opinion. It's impossible to escape the problem of God. When I have the time, I'll work out the formula to be used on great occasions. We must have something perfect, both in thought and in form. It's my opinion that we should organize marriage in such a way that couples do not present themselves one by one before the officer of the civil authority. If each couple assembles a following of 10 relatives or friends, with 50 couples, we shall have 500 participants, all the elements of a majestic ceremony. At present, the officer of the civil authority is faced with an impossible task. How do you expect the man to make an inspired speech 10 times a day? But what insipid twaddle they do sometimes pour forth. The expression, officer of the civil authority, is itself not very poetic. When I hear it, it reminds me of my father. I used occasionally to say to him, Father, just think. He used immediately to interrupt me. My son, I have no need to think. I'm an official. Hitler is engaged in skimming through an illustrated book on Spain. Montserrat, the word makes the legend come alive. It has its origin in the hostile encounter between the Moors and the Romano-Germanic elements. A lovely country. One can imagine the castle of the Holy Grail there.
Well, so what do you get that's most important in that? I think, I think you're right in the considering the context that probably this woman was probably a Christian scholar or something because she's talking about religion. I didn't really get that when you brought it up to me.
I thought it was neat the way he said, economizing and streamlining all along and, making things more practical. And he even brings in the fact of people getting married. You know, hey, we have this official of the government performing, or the church government, either one, performing this ceremony. And he says how much more efficient it would be if a whole lot of couples got married at one time.
No, I don't think it's efficiency, Ray. I think he's trying to bring in the element of God. He says you can't escape the problem of God. We have to have things done in a solemn manner and so on.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
When people get married by the civil authority rather than the church, since he was by then, here we are in 1942 in January, and he wasn't pushing religion. So if people go to the civil authority, there's not much grandeur about their marriage. But he says if you could get a bunch of them to get married at the same time,
yes.
They could get married in a large place, there'd be a lot of people there, and they could, play music and do everything because it would be worth it. And that would be a way to keep the majestic ceremonial aspect to it. That's what I thought he was saying.
Well, I agree with that. But, he mentions this officer of the civil authority. And when he marries a couple, he tries to make the ceremony quite meaningful and all. But then he says, how can you expect this guy to do this 10 times a day and still sound sincere about it?
Right.
And so if we can get 50 of them to marry at the same time, we'll be really doing well.
Yeah, then he can really do a big bang-up job. And
right, that's right.
Yeah, make
it do it once a day.
So there again is another example of how he's, anything that comes up that he starts thinking about, he's something to say about it, has some idea. I guess he might be hoping that someone who's listening to him might have something to do with that and might pass that idea along.
Oh, yeah.
In some way.
And now another topic here that I thought was pretty interesting, and it's, he tells about where he got a lot of his inspiration in this section. The night of the 2nd and 3rd January, 1942. When I go to Obersalzberg, I'm not drawn there merely by the beauty of the landscape. I feel myself far from petty things, and my imagination is stimulated. When I study a problem elsewhere, I see it less clearly. I'm submerged by the details. By night, at the Berghof, I often remain for hours with my eyes open, contemplating from my bed the mountains lit up by the moon. It's at such moments that brightness enters my mind. During my first electoral campaign, the question was how to win seats. Only the parties that had a certain importance had any hopes of doing so. I had no original formula for the campaign. I went up to Obersalzberg. At 4 o'clock in the morning, I was already awake, and I realized at once what I had to do. That same day, I composed a whole series of posters. I decided to overwhelm the adversary under the weight of his own arguments and what weapons he supplied us with. All my great decisions were taken at Obersalzberg. That's where I conceived the offensive of May 1940 and the attack on Russia.
Hey, let me break in here then.
Yeah.
Now here he's this idea that he always slept until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's not true. He says at 4 o'clock in the morning, he woke up and he started working on some ideas that he had. And he never usually really worked, slept past 10 or 11. He just didn't always get out into the... Well, when he was at Obersalzberg, there were always guests there also. And so they might be up and about, but he didn't show up, you know, in the main rooms until right before lunchtime, they say. But that doesn't mean he wasn't up and doing things. But I think that's interesting that he tells us here that he was... He was working on something, and he got up so early to get at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he mentions, when Hoffman is away for a few days, I miss him. And then he's interrupted by, I think, this Frau von Einhausen.
Yes, the same woman.
Exclaiming, "My Führer, if Professor Hoffman knew that, he'd be delighted." The Führer replies, "But he knows it very well. Not long ago, he wanted to give me a Menzel, M-E-N-Z-E-L.
Yeah, Menzel.
Mm-hmm. It was really very nice of him. I refused it. Even though I liked it, I wasn't going to deprive him of the picture. Besides, what would I have done with it? There'd have been no place for it at Linz. But for Hoffman's house, it's a treasure. The way in which Hoffman can do me a service is by finding a Rotman, for example, for my collection. Rotman's Greek and Roman landscapes at the Pinakothek,
right,
and then that's an art museum in Munich, have some extraordinary lighting effects. We have only one picture of him for Linz, but after all, we can't have everything. If anyone wants to study Rotman, he has only to go to Munich. Why is it that the screech of an owl is so disagreeable to a man? There must be some reason for that. I imagine it to be the confused hubbub of the virgin forest. Animals cry aloud when they're hungry, when they're in pain, when they're in love. The language of the birds is certainly more developed than we think. We say that cats are playful creatures. Perhaps they think the same thing of us. They endure us as long as they can, and when they've had enough of our childishness, they give us a scratch with their claws.
I often wonder why a cat who was being very nice, you know, with me on my lap and stuff, and then all of a sudden, and I'm trying to be nice to it, then all
right.
of a sudden it scratches me. It looks like, well, you nasty thing. It probably just got irritated by me.
There you go.
Hey, you know, speaking of pronunciations, Linz is, Z in German is like an S.
S.
Yeah, and the S is like a Z.
Oh,
but
all right.
More or less, less
yeah.
is two S's.
Okay, that's good
yeah.
to know.
So it's Linz.
Linz, okay.
Yeah.
Good.
All right. Well, that was kind of fun about it. I like it when he talks about art. Now,
yes.
I've heard of Menzel. Menzel is a very well thought of German painter.
Artist, yeah.
But I don't know Rotman, and I should have looked him up. See, I got busy doing other things, and I didn't get back to this and look up a bunch of things that I usually do. And I thought that I was ready for it, but I can look up Rotman right now. But when we go, I've got a timeline for the 5th, but I'll wait till we get there.
Okay.
So you go ahead.
3rd of January, 1942, midday. If there was a country that had particular reason to avoid war, it was Great Britain. The only way for her to keep her empire was to have a strong air force and a strong navy. That was all she needed. Oshima told me that to deceive the Americans, they sent Nomura and Kurosu, for it was notorious that both of them had always been in favor of an understanding with the United States. When one wants to deceive an adversary by simulating weakness, what a mistake to use a brave man and ask him to simulate the weakness for you. It's better to choose somebody who is out and out weak. And that's on that little section he spoke of there. But what he's mentioning the Japanese diplomats in Washington D.C., Nomura and Kurosu, and indeed they were really, really wanting to avoid war with the United States, trying to patch things over, trying to do anything to make direction relationships between the two countries go smoothly. But of course, they were being sabotaged in every way in hell from the Franklin Roosevelt's bunch. But it was interesting with his observation, you know, that Oshima told him that, hey, to deceive the Americans, we're going to send a couple of real compliant guys over there that seem to peace at any price. You know, we'll back off and do. We're deceiving the Americans by sending these people who are really sincerely wanting to avoid war.
Uh-huh, yeah. And he's mentioned Oshima before, and I imagine
yes.
he might again. Now, what is,
yeah,
is
comes,
Oshima his...
He comes up again, Carolyn, and I think there. When he comes up again, there is a definition of who he is.
Oh, okay, because I was wondering if he was like the, you know, the ambassador to Germany or something.
Yeah, he's a Japanese government official of some kind.
Okay. All right, well, Carl Rotman, spelled with two N's, two T's and two N's, and he mentions his landscapes, and he was a landscape painter. He, in the early 1800s, he lived from 1797 to 1850, and he's the most famous member of a whole family of painters in the Rotman family. I won't say any more about him, but anyway, there's a whole page on him at Wikipedia, C-A-R-L, Carl Rotman. There you go.
Okay, that's good. Now,
yeah.
This next section is lengthy. The night of 3rd,
yeah.
and 3rd and 4th of January, 1942.
It's very interesting, too.
Yes.
But there's quite a number of topics that he covers.
Now, we may break in parts
right.
of this.
Yeah, right. Let's
okay, see. He starts off saying, the SS shouldn't extend its recruiting too much. What matters is to keep a very high level. This body must create upon men of the elite the effect of a lover. People must know that troops like the SS have to pay the butcher's bill more heavily than anyone else, so as to keep away the young fellows who only want to show off. Troops inspired by a fierce will, troops with an unbeatable turnout, the sense of superiority personified. Now, I'm going to stop right there, Carolyn. I mentioned this in a previous program, but when I was in high school, a friend of my dad's had been, he was in the American Army, and he had been in Europe in the fighting. And when I had a chance to talk to him about his experiences over there, he said the German soldier was a very tough soldier. He said in their ordinary troops, if you want to call them that, were dressed in gray uniforms. And he said they were very tough fighters and all, but he said when you came up against those guys dressed in black, you better bring your lunch because you're going to be there a while. and he was talking about the SS. Mm-hmm. And this section right here is about exactly that, how those guys were such a cut above. And that's why he says it's troops like the SS that have to pay the butcher's bill more heavily than anyone else. And for us, it would be like the Marines maybe on Iwo Jima or Okinawa, but very, very tough troops.
Yeah, and they were expected to be. And yes. I like the way he says they wanted to keep away the young fellows who only wanted to show off.
Exactly.
Because it was a thing, you know, it was a matter of pride to be in the SS.
Yes.
But you didn't want these people who didn't understand what was being asked of them along with it, that they weren't just, you know, dressing in the uniform and getting all the glory of it, but
yes.
But that they really did need to be superior.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he says a lot of good things about Himmler, too, so let's go.
Oh, yes. And he goes on saying, as soon as peace has returned, the SS will have to be given its independence again, a complete independence. There has always been a rivalry between troops of the line and guardsmen. That's why it's a good thing that the SS should constitute, in relation to the others, an absolutely distinct world. In peacetime, it's an elite police capable of crushing any adversary. It was necessary that the SS should make war. Otherwise, its prestige would have been lowered. I'm proud when an Army commander can tell me that his force is based essentially on an armored division and the SS Reich division.
I think this is going to tell us some, but it might not be real clear, because I was interested in knowing who actually had the idea of the SS, whether it was Hitler or whether it was Himmler. But Hitler did have a special elite guard.
Yes.
Before the SS. Well, and then they called it the early SS. Because that's what SS stands for.
Schutzstaffel.
Yeah, which is, a protective force or something. So they were there to be around him. And then it just grew, but it took Himmler to develop it beyond just the little thing that Hitler had started, I guess. That's how it worked.
Right. Himmler has an extraordinary quality. I don't believe that anyone else has had, like him, the obligation to deploy his troops in such constantly difficult conditions. In 1934, the old gentleman was still there, meaning Hindenburg. Even afterwards, 1,000 difficulties arose. Being convinced that there are always circumstances in which elite troops are called for, in 1922 and 23, I created the Adolf Hitler shock troops. They were made up of men who were ready for revolution and knew that one day or another things would come to hard knocks. When I came out of Landsberg, everything was broken up and scattered in sometimes rival bands. I told myself then that I needed a bodyguard, even a very restricted one, but made up of men who would be enlisted without restriction, even to march against their own brothers. Only 20 men to a city, on condition that one could count on them absolutely, rather than a suspect mass. It was Maurice, Schreck, and Haydn who formed in Munich the first group of Tuffens that were thus the origin of the SS. But it was with Himmler that the SS became that extraordinary body of men devoted to an idea, loyal unto death. I see in Himmler our Ignatius de Loyola. With intelligence and obstinacy against wind and tide, he forged this instrument. The heads of the SA, for their part, didn't succeed in giving their troops a soul. At the present time, we've had it confirmed that every division of the SS is aware of its responsibility. The SS knows that its job is to set an example and to be not to seem, and that all eyes are upon it, to be it, not to just seem it, and all
yeah.
eyes are upon it, yeah. The role of Sepp Dietrich is unique.
Well, let's talk about this SS
okay.
a little more. I think
yeah.
This gets me all turned on when I hear talk like this.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it just kind of stirs me. And when he says, he's saying here what interested me was that as much as he thought of the SA and how helpful they were and all, he's saying that their leaders didn't succeed in giving them a soul, and that Himmler succeeded in giving a kind of a soul to to the SS, a deeper meaning. Well, I guess part of all that spiritual. Now, I don't want to use that word, religious or that. What would you call it? That ritual kind of stuff that they worked up. And not everybody. I don't think all the SS were initiated into all of that stuff. Do you?
Well,
certainly, I don't think the guard troops in the camps and so on.
You know, he made them know that they were elite, and that they had that they were expected to live up to it. It was such a pride for them.
Mm-hmm.
That they were looked up to, not just by the common folks on the street, but with the fellow soldiers who were not in the SS. You know, they were like, you know, those guys are something else. And it was a pride in their units. It was a pride in their organization. And that, to me, is him instilling that soul in them that instills such a confidence that the thought of retreat or defeat never crossed their minds. And that's what
those words, loyal unto death,
yes.
that was no joke. I mean, they
right.
were to defend either the Führer or the nation, with their lives.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That took quite a lot to go into the SS. A lot of people, a lot of men decided not to, and probably was best for them not to. You know, it's a you could be a great brave warrior for the Germany and not be in the SS. In the Wehrmacht, also, and it was just a different kind of thing. And sometimes the SS were maybe a little ruthless. You know, in the way they went about things. I don't mean that they were slaughtering people, but I mean, you know, they were just harder thinking.
Well, they had to be, because they knew that they were the ones that were going to be sent to the place that was most in need of the toughest resistance.
That's right.
And they knew they were the ones.
That's right. So it's really interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm. The role of Sepp Dietrich is unique. I've always given him opportunity to intervene at sore spots. He's a man who's simultaneously cunning, energetic, and brutal. Under his swashbuckling appearance, Dietrich is a serious, conscientious, scrupulous character. And what care he takes of his troops. He's a phenomenon in the class of people like Frundsberg, Zeithen, and Seydlitz. He's a Bavarian Rangel, someone irreplaceable. For the German people, Sepp Dietrich is a national institution. For me personally, there's also the fact that he's one of my oldest companions in the struggle.
Now, he was regular Army, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I need to read about him. I've heard his name forever, and, you know, I know enough to respect him, but I don't really actually know the story of his life.
I read a little bit about him today, when he was born, and you know, he died in 1966. He was as dedicated as a person could be to his country and to his Führer,
mm-hmm.
And loyalty to death, and that's what he was. He was. And the military, everybody looked up to the guy, too.
Yeah, well, I just don't know what all the things he participated in.
Well, he's the one that rescued Mussolini's mistress that, what was her name when she
was mistress.
Yeah, that's what she was called.
Yeah, I know, but they had to go and rescue her, huh?
Yeah, and Sepp Dietrich was in charge of that operation and pulled it off.
Well, you're not thinking about the rescue of Mussolini. No.
Oh, yeah.
Rescue Mussolini, was the guy that was in charge of that was that one-eyed guy. What's
yes.
That?
And gosh, I should know his name immediately.
I know it, but it's not coming
right.
to me. But that wasn't Sepp Dietrich. But
no.
Was Sepp Dietrich part of that operation or what?
I don't know if he was in on that one.
Oh, he was in on the Mistress.
Yes.
He did the Mistress one. Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the tragic situations we've been through was in Berlin in 1930. How Sepp Dietrich could impose his personality. It was just before the elections on which everything depended. I was waiting at Munich for the results of the counting. Adolf Mueller came in and very excited and declared, "I think we've won. We may get 66 seats. I replied that if the German people could think correctly, it would give us more than that. Within myself, I was saying, if it could be 100. Suddenly, we found ourselves with the certainty of 100 seats. Mueller offered to stand a round of drinks. It went up to 107. How to express what I felt at that moment? We'd gone up from 12 seats to 107.
Yeah, that's exciting. Mm-hmm. This was in 1930.
Yeah.
And he says, what does that got to do with Sepp Dietrich?
Oh, he was, he helped by, if you want to call it, campaigning for the National Socialist Party. He was one of the leaders in getting the posters out, organizing meetings and things like this.
Okay.
Anything Hitler asked him to do or said this needs to be done and turn it over to him. And it was to get the party elected.
Oh, so he gets a lot of credit for that
yes.
that victory that
yes.
they had. That was really something. Boy, that is exciting, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And it happens.
And then he kind of jumps to a little bit of an aside here. I cannot endure schoolmasters. As always, the exceptions confirm the rule, and that's why young people become all the more attached to the exceptional ones. After the First World War, the situation at the universities was difficult. The young officers who had a short time ago been at the front were somewhat awkward pupils. One day, I had an opportunity to hear a speech by Goering, in which he declared himself resolutely on the side of German honor. My attention had been called to him. I liked him. I made him the head of my SA. He's the only one of its heads who ran the SA properly. I gave him a disheveled rabble. In a very short time, he had organized a division of 11,000 men.
See, I wonder how many people know that about Goering.
Right. It was something yeah. I wasn't aware of.
No, not I wouldn't have ever come to my mind. You can read about these things and then forget about them. But mm-hmm. he did an yeah. awful lot. That's why Hitler stayed so loyal to him later, even
sure.
when people thought he should be replaced as head of the Luftwaffe. And some, you know, or, but it wasn't that clear cut. You know, Goering
uh-huh.
could do a good job, and sometimes things didn't go well, and people blamed it on him. But anyway, Hitler stayed loyal to him because. I think because he had contributed so much in the growth of the party and the growth of the success of the government.
Right.
He was a very smart man too. You know, when they took those IQ tests of the Nuremberg war criminal
yes.
defendants,
uh-huh.
I think his was 137 or something like.
Wow.
That.
One
of the higher ones. I don't
right.
trust them testing those men. And how good
right.
for the how alert were they when they were in that prison, and you know being treated like they were as far
sure.
as getting the best scores out of them, but anyway, some of them had some really high scores.
Mm-hmm. And young Lutz, L-U-T-Z-E.
Yeah, that's Lutzi, wouldn't it be Lutzi?
Lutzi.
Did you look it up?
No, I didn't look him up.
You can say Lutz. I don't know.
Lutzi has
is
gone
it?
Off. He has gone off to the front as
yeah.
a volunteer.
This is Victor Lutz. Victor
uh-huh.
Lutz, he was a very, very good man and someone Hitler held in very high esteem.
Oh, yeah, he's fixing to tell you that here.
Yeah.
He says, "Let's hope nothing happens to him. He's truly a pattern of what a young man should be, perfect in every way. When he has had a long enough period of training at the front, I'll take him on to my staff. He has plenty of breeding." On one occasion, Ing, is it I-N-G-E?
Yeah, Ing, probably his wife.
And he had come to Ober-Salzburg. They must have been 13.
It's his companion.
He says they must have been 13 and 14 years old. Inge had done something that was not too well behaved, no doubt. And then he says he turned to us and made the observation, meaning Lutzi turned to him and said, "What young people are coming to nowadays?" That's a 13-year-old saying that about a 14-year-old. I was present one day at the burial of some National Socialist comrades who'd been murdered. I was struck by the dignified attitude of their families. Sometime later at Nuremberg, they were burying the Austrian soldier Schumacher, who had likewise been murdered. Everything was cries and lamentations, an appalling spectacle.
Oh, he's picking on the Austrians now.
There you go. Have pity on the pessimist. He spoils his own existence. In fact, life is endurable only on condition that one's an optimist. The pessimist complicates things to no purpose. In my section, there was a spirit of open larking. Now, what the Fuhrer is talking right here, what he's talking about was his service in World War One, and where he was serving. And this is a kind of a humor shot here. In my section, there was a spirit of open larking. Apart from the runners, we'd had no link with the outside world. We had no radio set. What would have happened to us, by heaven, if we'd been a group of pessimists? The worst thing of all is a pessimistic commanding officer. A man like that can paralyze everything. At that stage, a man is no longer a pessimist, he's a defeatist. How could I have been successful without that dose of optimism which has never left me, and without that faith that moves mountains? A sense of humor and a propensity for laughter are qualities that are indispensable to a unit. On the eve of our setting out for the Battle of the Somme, we laughed and made jokes all night. Young people are optimists by nature. That's an inclination that should be encouraged. One must have faith in life. It's always useful to be able to make comparisons between events. Thus, when faced with a difficult situation, I always remember what our situation was like in 1933. It's not enough to be inclined to optimism. One must have a certain youthfulness into the bargain. It's lucky that I went into politics at 30, became Chancellor of the Reich at 43, and am only 52 today. One is born an optimist just as one is born a pessimist. With age, optimism gets weaker. The spring relaxes. When I suffered my setback in 1923, I had only one idea, to get back in the saddle. Today, I'd no longer be capable of the effort which that implies. The awareness that one is no longer capable of that has something demoralizing about it. I believe blindly in my nation. If I lost that belief, we'd have nothing left to do but to shut up shop.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I mean, he's 52. That shouldn't be that old, but he wasn't what you'd call a long liver. And then he had a lot of stress and everything too.
That's right.
So it took its toll on him.
Well, sure.
And he says it's something demoralizing. You know, I'm feeling all that. I'm a lot older than 52, but I realize more and more that I could never come back from things like I used to. And there is something demoralizing about it. It's
sure.
What you call recognizing you're getting old, or you're old or something, yeah. But he's honest about it.
Well, he is, and fate dealt him such a hand that his years were going to pile up on him a lot faster than for the ordinary person because of the responsibility he took upon himself, the assignment he took upon himself to lead his nation, and the stress and all that has to go with that responsibility before 1933, during the elections and things like that, and the social revolution, and then taking command. And you know, at his age, I think it was 44 in 1933, and It aged him very rapidly, of course. And then, of course, then by this 1942, when he's 52, he's in a war that's a life or death struggle. So the years piled up very heavily on him, and I think that's why he observed that I couldn't do that anymore. I couldn't jump back in the saddle as quick as I used to.
Right. And, you know, during those years of the 20s, he worked incessantly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he worked all the time, and he kept long hours too, as he says. You know, he'd be up very late, and get up early, and he would he just, you know, so much to do, and he was totally dedicated to reaching this goal that he wanted to gain power, so he could fix Germany and get it out of its terrible decline. That's what he devoted himself to.
And I think that mentioning the importance of optimism, that shows on him every time we read something about him. You know, no matter how rough and bad things may be going, he always have this optimistic outlook that, hey, hang in there, we can beat this thing. And to me, that was one of his greatest qualities as a leader, was to always exhibit the confidence that, yeah, things are rough, but we're going to come out of this.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because he didn't want to ever be a pessimist. He thought that was death. You know, that was the end. But a lot of people will blame him or put things on him that he was too optimistic, that he expected things to go well when they couldn't possibly, and things like that. But that's part of this whole belief system that he's telling us about right now.
That's right.
That he thought that was so necessary. And probably on the whole, it is.
Oh, absolutely. I feel it had to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A poor man like Wiedemann, what's left for him to do now? Every crisis has an end. The only question is whether one will survive the crisis. A winter in which the thermometer remains frozen at 50 degrees below freezing point simply doesn't exist. What matters is not to give way in any circumstances. It's wonderful to see a man come through a desperate situation, but it's not given to many beings to master a hostile fate. Throughout my life, that was my daily bread. First of all, the poverty I experienced in my youth. After that, the sometimes inextricable difficulties of the party. Next, the government of the country. But luckily, nothing lasts forever, and that's a consoling thought. Even in raging winter, one knows that spring will follow. And if, at this moment, men are being turned to blocks of ice, that won't prevent the April sun from shining and restoring life to these desolate spaces. In the South, the thaw starts in May. In the Crimea, it's warm in February. At the end of April, it's as if someone had waved a magic wand. In a few days, the snow melts and everything becomes green again. This passage from one season to the next is made, so to speak, without transition. It's a powerful upthrusting of sap, nothing that can be compared to what happens in our part of the world. Man loses in a moment the memory of the things that have made him suffer. Otherwise, man would live in constant anguish. At the end of 9 months, a woman forgets the terrible pains of childbirth. A wound is forgotten at once. What is strange indeed is that at the moment of being wounded, one has merely the sense of a shock without immediate pain. One thinks that nothing important has occurred. The pain begins only when one is being carried away. All that gave rise to incredible scenes, especially in 1914, at the period when formalism had not yet lost its rights. The wounded, who could hardly remain on their feet, used to stand at attention to ask their captain for leave to be evacuated. At bottom,
that's a powerful paragraph.
Yes, it is, and I appreciate you interrupting right there, because when I read that, two or three days ago, and then again today, I thought, wow, you know, that he's talking about that formalism, mm-hmm. that respect for authority, and that always, you know, even though these guys were,
you know, wounded and in a lot of pain or whatever, they got up and asked to be evacuated and stood at attention, you know.
Yeah,
and
amazing.
Yes, yes. And takes a special breed for that. And then, in fact, the next thing he says at bottom, all that's excellent for our race. It's excellent also for the German woman, for the women adore the males. The men of the Nordic countries have been softened to this point, that their most beautiful women buckle their baggage when they have an opportunity of getting their hooks on a man in our part of the world. That's what's happened to Göring with his Karin. There's no rebelling against this observation. It's a fact that women love real men. It's their instinct that tells them.
Now, he's saying here that the men of the Nordic countries are too soft.
Yeah, they've weakened.
Yeah, and that the Germans, he's talking about the Germans, is our part of the world, are the real men, are the stronger men, and that the women like them. And, they, of course, he's using the example of Göring's Swedish wife, Karin, who fell for him.
Yeah.
I don't know. Sometimes, you know, he's kind of showing some prejudice. But, you know, he's just talking. But he's obviously thinks this at the moment, just has some reason to say it.
Yeah, and he wants his people to know how much he believes in them. And you know, by giving them those words like that, like, you know, the menfolk, the German menfolk are greatly desired. Well, you know, hey, their Führer is saying that. So it's a confidence builder.
I feel the same way, and I don't have really experience with it. I don't know what I'm going by, pictures or something. But I think, that the further north you go, if you go way up into the Scandinavian countries, a lot of the men don't seem very tough or manly. They look a little, I don't know what to say. I don't want to insult anybody, and I don't mean that. I think they're probably very high quality. But there's something, I guess I've seen them in films or in stuff on TV and stuff. I don't know. When you go just a little bit down, a little bit further south, they get tougher. They get tougher looking, and they get better. I agree with that estimation of what would be attractive. And then when you get down into the Mediterranean, which is not necessarily my cup of tea, but you can have real manly men, but some of it's kind of put on sometimes.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, just as an aside there, Carolyn, there's this Texas mystique that a lot of the rest of the United States has been subjected to for a long time. And I've read quotes from military leaders like Patton saying that, you know, hey, give me 50 Texas Marines or whatever, and I can do this. And it's because people think that down in this section of the country or where we are, this historical fight readiness and things like this, it makes for a tougher breed of people. And I've heard that from friends that live in the Midwest and up in Idaho and things like this, about when they think of Texas, they think of a different breed of people who are cut above or a little tougher as far as the physical stuff goes. And that's how I related with him telling the Germans, you know, that, hey, you guys are cut above. Those other fellas have gone soft on us and a little bit, and the women admire this leadership. So, anyway.
Yeah, he's going to go. I don't know if we – I don't want to say ahead of what he says, but he's saying women like real men. Did he already say that?
Yes.
Yeah, he did.
That's what he said, yeah.
True.
But, yeah. And he says, in prehistoric times, the women looked for the protection of heroes. When two men fight for the possession of a woman, the latter waits to let her heart speak until she knows which of the two will be victorious. Tarts adore poachers.
Now, what are the poachers?
Well, poachers to me are people who kill animals out of season or on the sly.
Yeah.
You know, and they're not usually of good character, things like this. But, you know, to me, he threw that in as an opposite of just what he'd been saying. You know, a good woman, she's going to, these two guys are fighting over her. She's not going to take sides until this fight starts going heavily one way, and then she'll take the hero. But then he throws in, but those who aren't real women, those tarts, well, they adore poachers. Well, it's like, what do you expect? You know, they'll settle for much less. That's how I read that.
Okay, probably, and everybody's probably got a good laugh out of that.
Yeah, I think
but
so.
But they understood it. I don't understand it too well.
Uh-huh. At the moment on the Eastern Front, I'd prefer to lead a section of poachers in an attack rather than a section of those lawyers who condemn poachers.
Well, the lawyers are the worst.
That's right.
Always.
That's right. Yeah, and as bad as reputation or as looked down upon as these poachers are, he would rather have them, you know, in his fighting force than these lawyers who condemn those poachers. I'm impressed by the opinion of the Japanese, who consider that the Englishman is a much better soldier than the American. The fact that the Englishman was beaten by us will not prevent him from believing in his superiority. It's a matter of upbringing. At the beginning of the First World War, the English were not accustomed to artillery fire. After a bombardment of 4 hours, they were broken, whereas our fellows could hold out for weeks. The English are particularly sensitive to threats on their flanks. All in all, the English soldier has not improved since the First World War. The same thing is true, by the way, of all our opponents, including the Russians. One can even say that the Russians fought better during the First World War. I intended to attack in the West right away in the autumn of 1939, but the season was too far on. The battle in Africa is at present a battle of materials. Rommel has been lacking tanks. The others still had some. That explains everything, and if Rommel lacked tanks, that's because we couldn't transport them. And then this little part right here was a good bit of humor. I mean, I know people around him thought this was something. He says, the expression blitzkrieg is an Italian invention. We picked it up from the newspapers. I've just learned that I owe all my successes to an attentive study of Italian military theories.
Oh, so he's being totally...
Yes,
very
facetious.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. In former days, when I arrived by motor car in a town where I was expected, I always stood bareheaded, and I stayed like that sometimes for hours, even in the worst weather. I sincerely regret that age and my health no longer allow me to do that. At bottom, I could endure much more than the others, including those who were waiting for me in the open air, whatever the weather. The military salute is not a fortunate gesture. I imposed the German salute for the following reason. I'd given orders at the beginning that in the army I should not be greeted with the German salute. But many people forgot. Fritsch drew his conclusions and punished all who forgot to give me the military salute with 14 days confinement to barracks. I, in turn, drew my conclusions and introduced the German salute likewise into the army. On parades, when mounted officers give the military salute, what a wretched figure they cut. The raised arm of the German salute, that has quite a different style. I made it the salute of the party long after the Duce had adopted it. I'd read the description of the sitting of the Diet of Worms, in the course of which Luther was greeted with the German salute. It was to show him that he was not being confronted with arms, but with peaceful intentions. In the days of Frederick the Great, people still saluted with their hats, with pompous gestures. In the Middle Ages, the serfs humbly doffed their bonnets, whilst the noblemen gave the German salute. It was in the Ratskeller at Bremen, about the year 1921, that I first saw this style of salute. It must be regarded as a survival of an ancient custom which originally signified, see, I have no weapon in my hand.
He's calling what's called today the Nazi salute.
Yes.
It's the German salute.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And why can't it be seen as the German salute? Because once the Nazis started using it, they contaminated it.
But
huh?
You know the Romans used that.
Well, I know. It's been used a lot, but I guess that since the Nazis used it, now decided that it can't be used anymore.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And as he says here, this was an ancient custom which originally signified, see, I have no weapon in my hand. And, you know, when they put that arm up in the air and outstretched and turned a little bit to their right, it shows an empty hand and a gesture.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not. It looks good, too, which I think he says here. Because did he already say that when you do the military salute, he thought it looked bad when you're on a horse somehow? Right? Where'd you go? Oh, there's a problem with this call. Hold while they're trying to get the call. Are you there? Are you there now?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. You might have lost me. I didn't hear you for a few minutes, but Well, I see you don't have the Skype thing. The Skype said that there was just a little bit of an interruption.
Let me just. He says, I introduced the salute into the party at our first meeting in Weimar. The SS at once gave it a soldierly style. It's from that moment that our opponents honored us with the epithet Dogs of Fascist.
Okay, you know, and that's another one you pronounce a little funny. It's fascist.
Yeah.
I've never heard it ever pronounced other than fascist. Where have you gotten that other?
It's what we, to us, fascists was a Yankee pronunciation. And what fascist is what it's, you know, that's what I heard when I was going to school and whatever. Fascist, it's a fascist. But fascist, I've heard that as well.
Well, I think what you're saying sounds like it would be right, but yet I never hear anybody ever using that. We'll have to check into that.
Yeah, good idea.
But you can go ahead with whatever, however you do it.
Okay. Thinking of that time reminds me of Schubner Richter's Sacrificed. What dignity his wife displayed. It's a heartbreaking grief to me that Dietrich Eckart did not live to see the party's rise. What a revenge and what an achievement that was for all those who were with us as long ago as 1923. Our old Nazis, they were grand fellows. They'd everything to lose at that time and nothing to win by coming with us. What do you think of the use of that word Nazis right there, Carolyn?
Well, yeah, good comment. He's using it. So, and I used to say I've caved in and gone along with okay, we should never use that word. But for a while there, for several years back, I know that they sometimes use that word themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And Goebbels did, and now here Hitler's using it,
yeah.
And they call themselves. In fact, there might be some places in Mein Kampf where he uses it, where they're talking about themselves. And it was in use by the population and not in a derogatory
yes,
way.
Yes, and there's your key right there.
Right.
Yeah, that it definitely was not derogatory. It was simply referencing the National Socialist German Workers' Party, written
right.
out in German.
Nazi Soci.
Yes.
And they said Nazi for short, Nazi
right.
Soci for
right.
national, because national was Nacional. I was arguing that whole thing on a radio program once, but then I decided that since it does get so disgusting when you're reading the usual stuff and how they can only ever use the word Nazi, never can they in the press and the books they write and so on by our enemies, that you finally say, I'm sick of this and I'm not going to use that word.
Right, and that's what I do. I always, if I'm referencing this in speech or in writing, I always use just NS or National Socialist.
Yeah, I use NS a lot too.
Yeah. Okay. In 10 years, the expression, the Führer, will have acquired an impersonal character. It will be enough for me to give this title an official consecration for that of Reich Chancellor to be blotted out. Even in the Army, they now say the Führer. This title will later be extended to cover persons who will not have all the virtues of a leader, but it will help to establish their authority. Anyone at all can be made a president, but it's not possible to give the title of Führer to a nobody. Another good thing is that every German can say, "My Führer." The others can only say, "Führer." It's extraordinary how quickly this formula has become popular. Nobody addresses me in the third person. Anyone can write to me, "My Führer, I greet you." I've killed the third person and dealt a death blow to the last vestiges of servility, those survivals of the feudal age. I don't know how the expression was born. I've nothing to do with it. It suddenly implanted itself in the people and gradually acquired the strength of usage. What a happy inspiration I had to refuse the title of President of the Reich. You can imagine it. President Adolf Hitler.
So what's he saying here? That he's saying that he didn't create the expression Führer for himself.
Right.
That
the people started referring to him as that, calling him that.
Well, the Führer has been in use for a long time.
Yes. Yes.
But I guess they started calling him. I have to look into this.
Mein Führer, mein Leader. You know, the one gifted leader among the people. And he's exactly correct when he separates that from president. You know, a president's elected by a bunch of people and things like this, and it doesn't set up, because the word Führer to me means the absolute best you got that leads you.
Mm-hmm.
And a president doesn't certainly hardly ever fit that absolute best.
Yeah. And he's also saying that only Germans can say "My Führer." Is he saying that if you're not a German, you can't say "My Führer"?
Well, no, they can say Führer.
Yeah, they can't say "My Führer."
Right. Well, what he means there, when the Germans call him "My Führer," it shows their dedication to him, and that other people might refer to their. Let's say in some other country they might call it their leader Führer, but they wouldn't go far as to say "My Führer," because they aren't as devoted and loving of that leader as the Germans are of Adolf Hitler. That's how I took that.
Hmm. Well, or maybe it's, I don't know. I can't figure it out myself.
Uh-huh.
There's not enough to it there for me to go by.
He goes on. You want me to go ahead?
Yes.
There is no finer title than that of Führer, for it was born spontaneously in the people.
There it is.
Yeah, as for the expression "My Führer," I imagine it was born in the mouth of women. When I wished to influence the old gentleman, I used to address him as Herr General Field Marshal. It was only on official occasions that I used to say to him, "Herr President." It was Hindenburg, by the way, who gave prestige to the presidential title. These fine shades may seem to be trifles, but they have their importance. They're what give the framework its rigidity. The destiny of a word can be extraordinary. For 2,000 years, the expression Caesar personified the supreme authority. The Japanese also have their own expression to indicate the highest authority. They say Tenno. And that's spelled T-E-N-N-O, which means son of heaven. The Japanese are still at the point where we were 1,600 years ago before the church crept into the affair. Now, I thought that was a fascinating statement right there, Carolyn, and to me it was not a criticism like you say, well, those Japanese, they're behind us 1,600 years. I think it was a compliment. That's how I read it. The Japanese are still at the point where we were 1,600 years before the church crept into the affair and made that term seem like something that shouldn't be used.
Yeah. Yeah, that samurai thinking, the real warriors.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And, yeah, and Anyway, he says, one must never admit that the authority of the state and the authority of the party are two different things. The control of a people and the control of a state have to be combined in one person. And thus the Führer.
Okay, so he doesn't want to separate. He doesn't want there to be a state authority and a party authority. Mm-hmm. He's saying it has to be.
The party is the
one
state.
One has to do the yeah. both. One, yes. one has to do both, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, very good. And I like the way he's always referring to Hindenburg as the old gentleman.
Yes.
He always does.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I thought I missed the timeline, but we're still only on January 4th.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go
no,
ahead.
No, we didn't, because I'm waiting
that's right.
For the
You're going
fifth.
To 5th.
Yeah. yeah.
Okay.
So go ahead.
4th of January, 1942, midday. Special guests, Sepp Dietrich and Colonel Zeitzler.
Yeah, Colonel Zeitzler is the one who took the Halder's place when Hitler finally got rid of Halder. And he must not, that must not be yet, because he's still a colonel. But he must be there on the general staff. He must be staying at headquarters on the general staff, Zeitzler.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. The Italian high command has committed three great mistakes in strategy. The resulting disasters have deprived the Italian army of its former confidence. That's the explanation for its present mediocrity. It was, first of all, a mistake to hurl the best regiments of Bersagliari against solidly fortified French positions, the plans of which were utterly unknown to the Italian command, and to do so in the snow at a height of 3,000 meters, and that precisely at a time when aircraft could play no part. It's not surprising that these regiments were so sorely tested. We ourselves could not have achieved any result in such conditions. If they listened to me, they'd have taken the French in the rear by the Rhine Valley. The second mistake was Africa. The Italians had no protection against the British tanks, and they were shot like rabbits. Many senior officers fell beside their guns. That's what gave them their panic terror of tanks. Their third mistake was their fatal enterprise against Albania. For this attack, they used troops from southern Italy, exactly what was needed for a winter campaign in mountainous country without proper equipment over an impractical terrain and without any organization in depth. Of course, he's being sarcastic.
Well,
there.
I was wondering there.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so this thing against Albania was in mountainous country and difficult.
Right, and the troops from southern Italy, where the climate is a lot milder than northern, more mountainous, the soldiers, like the men, are not as tough.
Right.
And he says, yeah, this is exactly what you needed to fight that kind of fight. Of
okay, well, that helps, because I wasn't taking it that way, and I was thinking, well, I guess he thought a lot about these. He thought very highly of these southern Italian troops, but they weren't used for the right purpose, so now I understand. Well, that's very depressing. He goes through these three things that seem like they should know better, and why are they being so stupid? That, then they lose all these men, plus materials.
Right.
Terrible.
Right. You know, and he starts off by saying the mediocrity of the Italian high command has made these fatal mistakes, and he describes each of those mistakes, which have really rocked them back on their heels.
Just terrible to have allies like that.
That's right.
You know, how it just discourages you.
Mm-hmm.
They're not any help.
No.
Well, sometimes they were a help, but...
Right, but they became such a liability.
Yeah, really they did.
Okay, speaking of that, Keitel. We must see to it that the regiment of Bersagliari, that's an Italian term, meaning the elite army forces of Italy, we're expecting is sent immediately onto the job. They couldn't endure a long march in this season and in such conditions. Let's prevent these Bersagliari from becoming demoralized before they've even arrived at the front.
Yeah, because it's January, so bad weather, and these are Italians, so they're not used to.
Yes.
Maybe this kind of weather. So says, let's not... give them a hard time. Oh, my. Okay. Now he turns to Sepp Dietrich.
Yes, Hitler turns to Sepp Dietrich. Hoffman often speaks of his desire to have me visit his model farm. I can see from here what would happen. He'd photograph me entering a barn. What publicity for the sales of his milk. I'd be posted up in all the dairies. If I agreed to be photographed with that cigar between my teeth, I believe Reemsma would immediately offer me $500,000 marks. And why not just as well some publicity for a master furrier, a pelisse on my back, a muff in my hand, on the lookout to shoot rabbits. Once again, that was sarcastic stuff he was casting out.
Yeah, how they could use him in all these advertisements.
Yeah, advertisement. Yeah, the cigar makers and this furrier, you know, and so. Anyway, he says, I once did myself incalculable harm by writing an open letter to an innkeeper. I reproached him with the commercial demagogy of the brewers, who made themselves out to be benefactors of the small man, struggling to ensure him his daily glass of beer. Very soon, I saw, and this is A-M-A-N-N.
Amen.
Appear completely overwhelmed to tell me that the big beer halls were canceling their advertising contracts with the newspaper. That meant an immediate loss of 7,000 marks and of 27,000 over a longer period. I promised myself solemnly that I would never again write an article under the domination of rage. At the beginning of our activity, there were still no loudspeakers. The first ones that existed were the worst imaginable. Once at the Sports Palace in Berlin, there was such a cacophony that I had to cut the connection and go on speaking for nearly an hour, forcing my voice. I stopped when I realized that I was about to fall down from exhaustion. Kube was the man who had the most powerful voice of us all, the voice of a rhinoceros. He held out for only 20 minutes. Another time at Essen, it was an utter flop. The whole population had come to our meeting. Nobody understood a word. I was admired simply for my endurance. I had witnesses. Your wife, Brandt, herself confessed to me that it was completely incomprehensible.
Well, he's talking to Brandt, that doctor, probably Dr. Brandt, who was around a lot. And he and his wife both lived down in... had a house in Over Salzburg and were around a lot. So he's saying your wife, Brandt, was herself.
It was only gradually that we learnt the necessity of distributing the loudspeakers through the hall. One needs about 100, and not just one, placed behind the platform, which was what we had at the Sports Palace. Every word was heard twice, once from my mouth and then echoed by the loudspeaker. I also remember the German day of 1923 in Nuremberg. It was the first time I spoke in a hall that could hold 2,000 people. I had no experience as an orator. At the end of 20 minutes, I was speechless. Hitler again turns to Sepp Dietrich. Burdened with responsibilities as I am at this moment, I don't take unnecessary risk in moving about by aircraft, but you know that in the heroic days, I shrank from nothing. I only once had to abandon a flight, and that was against my will. It was at the end of an electoral campaign. I'd spoken at Flensburg, and I wanted to get back to Berlin, breaking my journey at Kiel. Captain Bauer interposes, "Yes, my Führer, it was I who insisted on your giving up that flight. First of all, it was a night flight, and our course was thick with heavy storms. Moreover, I had no confidence in the Met. I was sure of one thing, that some people would have been delighted to learn we'd broken our necks."
That's nice to hear. Mm-hmm. Captain Bauer speak up. See, all these people are there. Hanging around, you know, I mean, having dinner with him and so on.
Well,
go ahead.
And I was just going to say, Carolyn, like you had said before on a previous program, and you're exactly right, it would have been so nice had these fellows, these two guys who were taking these notes, been able to also write down what these other people said.
Well, yeah, and we've got a little bit of it here.
Yes.
Just a little bit.
Right.
You see how nice it is.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And you know what strikes me here is that I'm finally catching on here after Captain Bauer says to Hitler, yes, my Führer. And you know, I generally have had the idea somewhere, you know, kind of hanging around that all these Germans had to say, mein Führer, mm-hmm. you know, and it sounded kind of unnatural to me. And also it kind of gave the impression of obsequiousness, you know, that they all
yes.
had to make themselves less and call him mein Führer. And now I'm seeing how it was just natural.
Yes.
And that's the way they talked. And it was like, I don't want to say, I would say loving, but love. Yeah, but it is love and respect and,
exactly.
and so on. And it's not obsequious and it's not anything to make anybody less. That's why he allowed it, too. Because I thought, doesn't Hitler get tired of having people say mein Führer to him? But no, because I just had the wrong idea about it, and I bet all kinds of people do.
Yeah, I imagine they do. I always, and I've thought of it as, they use it as a term of affection for him.
Yeah, well, it's respect. It's respect,
you know,
yeah, but there's
a
certain
there's
amount
an
of affection
about
to it.
Yeah,
sure.
I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, 4th of January, 1942, evening. Special guests, Sepp Dietrich and Colonel Zeitzler. It has always been supposed that the employment of tanks depended on the existence of roads. Well, it's just been realized that the desert is the ideal terrain for them. It would have been enough for Rommel to have 200 more tanks. If we succeed in neutralizing Malta and getting new tanks to Africa, Rommel will be able to recapture the operational initiative. It's proper not to exaggerate. We haven't lost much. In any case, there's no question, quite the opposite of giving up the game. In my opinion, their victory will make the English withdraw a part of their forces from Africa. It's likely, for nobody in this war has sufficient reserves of aircraft to permit himself to immobilize them in sectors where they're not indispensable. On their side, especially, all their forces are constantly in the line. In fact, we are the only ones who still have a few reserves. The only problem for us is that of forcing the passage between Sicily and Tripolitania. On their side, they have to go all around Africa. They're aware of our strength in the Mediterranean and dare not use the classic route to India. As soon as they've stripped that sector, I'll send Rommel what he needs. The hollow charge means the death of the tank. Now, when he says hollow charge here, he's talking about it's kind of like a landmine, or it's a bomb used to throw under a tank to blow it, to make it totally useless. The tanks will have finished their career before the end of this war. We haven't used the hollow charge so far, but there's no more reason to wait since Italy has suggested to us a similar weapon. Secrets are badly kept among the Italians, and what Italy has today, the rest of the world will have soon. If the others have it, there'll be nothing left for us to do either but to pack up our tanks. With the help of this weapon, anyone at all can blow up a tank. When the Russians start up again in the spring, their tanks will be put out of action. 2 years ago, I had a new heavy anti-tank gun. In the meantime, the new enemy tanks have come into the line. Necessity teaches men not merely to pray, but ceaselessly to invent, and above all, to accept the inventions that are suggested to them. Every new invention so much reduces the value of the previous material that's it's a ceaselessly renewed struggle to introduce a novelty.
Well, you know, I need to understand this a little bit better because all through the battles on the Eastern Front, they weren't blowing up tanks like
that's
this
right.
with these hollow charges. So he's talking about something new that they've got that he thinks is going to come online and change everything, but it really didn't.
Yeah, and apparently the Italian research division had come up with that, and he thought, well, this can do us some good, but then he said the way the Italians cannot keep secrets, everybody else is going to have it soon anyway.
Yeah, but did they? I mean...
Right, and apparently it didn't hit production or as near as much as it should have, kind of like the V1 and the V2. It just barely got off the ground, and it was too late, too little too late.
Oh, well, that's too bad. If they, if the yes. Germans had had that without the others having it.
Yes, it would have been of invaluable usage against the Soviet.
Oh, gosh, I guess. Well, you know what? We have 4 minutes left, so I don't think we better start this new section.
Okay.
So I've written stop here, and we've got a couple minutes. We could still kind of sum up a little bit. Boy, there's a lot of good stuff coming up for next week. But,
oh, yeah.
I think some things were clarified that I wanted to have clarified, so I think we did a good job tonight. I want to thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Well, all right. Do you have anything, any final words to say about? It's almost January 5th. You know, I had that timeline.
Yes.
But I could give it next week, which I probably will. But it does say for the January 5th, 1942 was the beginning of a major Red Army offensive under General Zhukov.
Yes.
So this is the Reds have regrouped, and they've started their first offensive. I guess this is probably the first offensive, but that's not good. I mean, from our point of view, since we're Third Reich fans.
Well, during that downtime of that bodacious winter that they were having up there, you know, we talked about that, having to keep tanks, motors running.
That very first winter, too, was so terrible.
Yeah. Well, and it was during that time that this huge, massive American operation to get supplies, armaments, tanks, everything they could get into Russia through Alaska and into Siberia, and so that the Russians could go on an effective offensive as soon as possible, you know, and that happened to hit there in January. But Soviets would never have been able to do that without the food and equipment and gear that the anti-communist capitalists who, you know, profess to be, if they hadn't given that to the Soviet, that offensive would not have been possible.
Well, we can talk about that more next week. Yeah, these are some of the bad things where once, because already the United States is in the war now, and it changes everything. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to wish you a happy 4th of July for tomorrow, right, Ray?
Exactly.
And we're going to say good night. Thank you for listening, and ask you to come back next week.
Thanks, folks.